So Frank Worrell passed away at a very young age, and there was something about the passing also of Collie Smith.
Yes.
I remember my father telling me something about the death of Collie Smith.
Yes, Collie Smith's death had a very big impact, because after the 1957 tour of England, Worrell had virtually retired from Test cricket. But the death of Collie Smith in 1959 spurred him to resume his cricketing career, much to the benefit of the West Indies. Just to recap briefly, yet we could not forget his inequities when batting. At the age of 19, Worrell became the youngest triple century maker, making 308 not out when playing for Barbados against Trinidad, sharing an undefeated partnership with John Goddard of 502. 2 years later, against the same opposition, he scored 255 not out in a record undefeated stand of 574 with Clyde Walcott. In 1947-48, the MCC tourists gazed in admiration at his class. In his first test match, Frank charmed his way to 97, only to cap this with 131 not out in his second test. In three tests in 48, he scored 294 runs against England at an average of 147. But it was in England in 1950 that his fluid stroke play was seen at its best. Having already delighted Northern spectators with a record 1501 runs for Radcliffe in the Central Lancashire League the previous season, he entertained a wider audience when he lazily stroked the English bowling all over Nottingham to score 261. Enjoying a stand of 283 with Everton Weeks at a rate of 80 runs an hour. In six test innings, Worrell comprised 539 runs for an average of 89.83. The manner of his run making is as unfortunate omission in the victory calypso we are just listening to. In other words, he should have been mentioned in that calypso about the 261 at Nottingham, which was really a tremendous record at the time.
Now, he's got a fantastic individual record, and my concern is about his leadership as a captain. What was special about him winning, leading the West Indies to win, and how did he become the captain of the West Indies team? It was in this year when I think it was a type of a black-white situation.
Right.
I think he was the first
black
captain.
Well, there had been a big controversy in 1955. Before the Australians arrived in the West Indies in 55, the West Indies Cricket Board of Control did something that seemed strange by appointing Dennis Atkinson and Bruce Paradoo as captain and vice-captain, respectively, for the tour of New Zealand, which was to take place in 1956, a year after the Australian visit. Only after the announcement had sunk in and caused a good deal of controversy did the board announce that Jeff Stalmy and Dennis Atkinson would be captain and vice-captain, respectfully, for the Australian series about to start. Shortly before the first test, Jeff Stalmy hurt his finger in practice and had to withdraw from the side. So when you turn to the first test match for the West Indies against Australia in 1955, you see F.M. Worrell, E.D. Weeks, C.L. Walcott being led by an inexperienced Atkinson. The exclusion,
just because he was white.
Right. The exclusion of black men from captaincy becomes all the more pointed when you see that the prime ministers and chief ministers from all those islands were black. It must be noted at the time that Frank Worrell had led a Commonwealth team in 1950-51 as field captain under Leslie Ames, which included South Africans, and had been vice captain under Stalmier for the West Indies team in 1953 and 1954, which was prior to the Australian tour, against India and England in the West Indies. Therefore, he had all the qualifications of leadership, an experienced test player, senior member of the side, having toured and played in all the cricketing countries of the world, yet he was passed over in favor of Dennis Atkinson. So you have to say that this was the most blatant form of discrimination ever carried out by the West Indies Cricket Board of Control.
What we talk about? Jones and Claude Tate.
The line tennis number one, you know. How are you there, Claude?
Vernon, welcome. How you doing?
Not too bad, thanks. Keith, how are you doing?
Fine, fine. Good to hear you again.
Yeah, well, good to hear you too. A lot of statistics, a lot of memories, man.
Oh, yes. For me, too.
Yes, yes.
How do you remember Sir Frank Worrell, Vernon?
Well, I knew Sir Frank very, very well. You know, I know his mother, his sister, his father, his brother. Saw Frankie, he's older than I am, but I saw him at his best. When I say at his best, I mean in the Caribbean, because when he went away, he was the kind of player that I don't think many people outside of Barbados actually saw. He was a very beautiful player, and he hit the ball quite hard. Keith, I don't think that you ever saw Frankie hitting the ball as hard as he really used to hit it. And I think he became a little more cultured from the standpoint of English batsmanship, as we know the Englishmen to play. But Frankie was very, very beautiful, a very beautiful player. Something like Lawrence Roe at his best, I think, surpassed, and this is going to cause a controversy too, Roe at his best was perhaps a little more beautiful than Frankie. Then Frankie came back from England.
Vernon, you're not actually saying that he hit the ball harder than Clive Lloyd, are you?
He used to hit it very hard. not consistently hard. Clive Lloyd hit the ball consistently hard. I saw Clive, the youngster. I saw him hitting the ball in England tremendously hard. I saw all the players that we have today batting and hitting the ball very hard. But Frank Worrell did hit the ball extremely hard to compare with Everton Weeks and Clay Walker. I mean really hard. Clay Walker hit it perhaps consistently harder. But when Frankie hit the ball, it did stay well hit.
Yeah, but I always looked on Frankie as more of a technician, because I remember seeing him make 237 against the Indians in 1953. And he always placed the ball directly between the fielders that they all did was turn and chase the ball to the pavilion.
Yes, I agree with you. At that point, Frankie had spent quite a bit of time in England. Mm-hmm. See, by then he had perfected, I think, a little more, but that did not take away from the fact that he was a very, very good player even before he went to England. What I'm saying is that you did not get an opportunity to see him really hitting the ball hard, because Frankie did, in fact, hit the ball very, very hard. But the point is, I want to say to you who do not really know Frankie from being a youngster, Frankie lived a full life. You know, he was frisky. He was not. I wouldn't say he was a vagabond, but he was frisky. He played a lot. You know, he really had a lot of boy days, and he came up in a school of hard knocks. And the prejudices that he experienced in Barbados helped to make him a better man. So therefore, he knew how people did not like to be treated. And as a result of that, he treated people with the kind of respect and the dignity that you saw displayed by Frankie in dealing with these other people that he led and people he had to communicate with. It's what made him so very great. I mean, people did not really accept Frankie as a great man until after Frankie had really gone away and come back and suffered at their hands throughout the Caribbean.
What do you think about him being passed over in 1955 for the captaincy?
Well, we knew it was going to happen. You know, we were very annoyed about the whole situation, but the temper of the time did not permit us to do anything about it. Even being like CLR James, though they were outraged by the whole situation, there was nothing they could do. We could curse privately, we could make threats and so on. But the temper of the time was such that we really couldn't do anything about it. You know, it's one of the blackest periods in the history of West Indies cricket. In the present period, say like in the 1925 on, if you look at the real history of it, you know, it was an extremely black time because of the quality of players that we had, quality of black players. You know, but it is something that we really could not have done anything about it because of the economic, the social aspect of it. You know, it's something that was there. You know, and the time was not right as we are going to say today, and we said in the past, and we'll say again in the future. Certain times were not just right. Certain things to happen, and this is really the truth about it.
That's right. Vernon, we want to thank you for your input and your contributing to our program today. our discussion on one of the great cricketers of all time, the captain of the West Indies team.
You know, he just passed his 60th birthday, right?
That's right. Yes, August 1st.
Would have been 60 August 1st.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Vernon.
Have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Program for tonight, On the Ball, our tribute to Sir Frank Worrell, a late living legend whose time came a bit late and was remembered by the West Indies team much, much later than the times when he was to have been remembered. So Frank Worrell paid a lot of price for the things he went through,
yeah,
with the color bar and the everything. And my special guest tonight was Keith Jones. And Keith, a parting word?
Yes, I'd like to say that Frank Worrell was honored in Westminster Abbey on April 7th, 1967. 1,000 people turned up. And in the whole 900 years history of the Abbey, he was the only overseas sportsman that has ever been thus honored.
So Frank Worrell was inducted into cricket's only Hall of Fame only last year in Hartford, Connecticut. You want to thank you?
The Gospel according to St. John chapter 7 and verses 37 and 38. In the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, "If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believeth on me, as the scripture hath said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water." Out of him shall flow rivers of living water. Cross over the Jordan from Palestine, leave behind you the Sea of Galilee, and soon you pass into dry, sandy country, the outer limits of the great Syrian desert, El Hamed. Hundreds of miles of burning sand separate you from the green valley of the Euphrates further east. A waterless land, a dead land. Set out from Palestine, from the region round about Jerusalem, and travel east, and again you come to thirsty land and desert. For 1,000 miles and more, the great Arabian desert and the desert of red sandstone stretch before you, a land of emptiness, a land of thirst, a parched land. Or set out from the south, from Beersheba, in the green country of Palestine, and once you again you come to desert, to sand, to burning thirst, a land of death. It was in this desert, you remember, that the Jews wandered for 40 years. There in the desert of sin they endured thirst and they endured hunger. And there in the desert they cried out, "Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord and the hand of Egypt." Bitter at the sight of men, women and children, hungry and thirsty, threatened with death from famine, they cried out against Moses and Aaron, saying, "Ye have brought us into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly of people." And then they pitched their tents in the parched land of Rephidim, where they camped, and there was no water. And yet again their voices rose against Moses, their voices rose against Aaron. "Wherefore is this, that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt to kill us, and our children, and our cattle with thirst?" And it was there that God said to Moses, "Behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb, and thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, so that the people may drink." The memory of the desert, the waterless land, was burned deep into the consciousness of every Jew. They knew in their bones what water meant, that water was life. They knew that the desert was death, that water was literally life. Every year they celebrated three great festivals, They celebrated the festival of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, which we often call the Passover. They celebrated the festival of the harvest, of the ingathering, and then at the close of the year, they celebrated the festival of the Feast of Tabernacles, the time when all the crops were gathered in, the last produce of the year, the corn, the wine, the oil. They called it the Feast of Tabernacles because of the memory of those 40 years of wandering in the wilderness when their fathers lived without home, without fields, without settled habitation, in huts. The festival lasted for 7 days. On each day of the seven, men fetched water, water from Siloah, poured it out before the altar. And the priest who poured, and the people who watched, while young had learned by heart the history of their forefathers. They knew by heart how Moses smote the rock and water flowed out. They knew the story of David, how when in exile he cried out that someone might give him to drink of the water from the fields where he had lived and grown up as a boy. They knew how at night one of his men left him, went to the well, fetched the water. They knew by heart the story of how David refused to drink it because a man had risked his life for it and how he poured it out before God. They knew by heart the song that he had sung, the song of the shepherd who led his people through green pastures and beside still waters. And now the last day of the feast had come, the great day of the feast. On the preceding day, the priest had poured out the water before the altar and had recited the promise of Isaiah, "Therefore with joy shall ye draw water out of the wells of salvation." On this last day, Jesus was present in the temple. In his mind, and in the minds of every Jew present there, was the memory of the desert, the memory of 40 years of wandering and thirst and hunger. In his mind also was the memory of 40 days when he spent in loneliness in the desert, hungering so much that the smooth round stones before him looked like loaves of bread. And as always, he looked out and he saw not simply the physical and the material, but the spiritual. Just as once he had seen men fishing from a boat on a lake, and he had cried out to them that he would make them fishers of men. Just as once he had passed through fields ripe for the harvest, and had said that the harvest truly was plenteous, but the reapers were few. So now he saw the needs of the Spirit. He looked round about him upon the crowded streets of Jerusalem, upon the precincts of the temple crowded with people, the temple itself. Every morning, every night, in his ears rang the sounds of the Roman trumpets. But he saw more. He heard the priest who cried, "With joy shall ye draw water out of the wells of salvation," and now he cried to them, transforming the spiritual, this physical thing into something spiritual, this water into a symbol of life, and saying to them, "If any man is thirsty, let him come to me. Whoever believes in me, let him drink. As scripture says, streams of living water shall flow out from within him." How could anyone who heard him fail to understand what he meant, fail to understand that the wells of salvation were within them? Here is a tremendous picture of the prodigality of goodness, the active outpouring of creative power, the transforming power of inexhaustible inner strength, streams of living water shall flow out from within him. Turn your minds now to our friend Frank Worrell. Think of him as you knew him. Think of the words that he said, the things that he did. I have tried to do this. One thing shines out as you think of him. There is never a mean word, never a petty action, never a diminishing of another man or woman. Of how many of us could this be said? There was in our friend a natural, easy generosity of spirit that came only from goodness. The streams of living water flowed out from him. Nor was there any pomp, any fuss, any self-importance. Think of that great tour in England when he led the West Indies to victory. The world was at his feet. The press showered praise upon him. Her Majesty the Queen honored him. He was for the West Indian the embodiment of achievement, of excellence measured by world standards, excellence, quality. This is what Sir Frank helped to build into this society of ours, this society in which, for so long a part of our history, there was no great tradition. This society in which, for so long a part of our history, the dominant motive was the exploitation of the human being, the commercial, the material, in which for so long there was no respect for men and women. He helped to build into this society of ours a sense of greatness, of respect for men and women, whether poor or rich, of fellowship where once there was hatred, of brotherhood where once there was bitter division. What a debt we owe to Frank Worrell, not simply for his cricket, but because of this quality of excellence which he built into our way of life. Cricket was his medium, but excellence was the man's purpose, excellence was the man's achievement. Every club in the West Indies would have been honored and had him as captain at the end of that tour. But what did he do? My brother told me how when he returned, he rang up and said that he wished to play for Boys Town. And said he, I will play under the captaincy. I think it's young Richards. My brother Hugh said, no, you come and play with us. We want you to come. But let young Richards play under your captaincy. Train him, teach him how to lead men. And so the man who won the highest honors at Lord's played for one of the poorest clubs in Kingston, leading a team of youngsters who had known the desert of neglect and poverty and insecurity and disregard. Out of this believing man, there flowed streams of living water, changing and transforming the lives of those round about him. This goodness was natural and easy and unassumed. It was so easy that one came to take it for granted, not recognizing how valuable it was. I think because he sought nothing for himself. The more honored he was, the more modest he was. Can you remember him claiming anything for himself? Can you remember any occasion on which he exploited his fame in order to win something for himself? What he found was a way of giving quickly when there was a hold up here and it was difficult to get play for the cricket pitch. He quietly went off in his car to Yellis a number of times and brought back play in his own car. Soon after he left us for St. Augustine to help with the development of the games and student activities there, he spotted in one of the clubs a young teenager who seemed to him a promising spinner. He became a father to the lad. He bought him his cricket gear. He set his feet on the path of manhood. This was the pattern of Frank Worrell's life. This was the way in which he lived. Streams of water, of life-giving goodness, flowed out of him to change the lives of others. And this was a great comfort to Velda Worrell. We pray for her and for their daughter. It was a comfort to her to know these things. I traveled with her last Wednesday as far as Antigua. She told me about a little boys' club in Trinidad, how the boys had saved up at Christmas time and bought a small gift for her husband. And they hadn't given it to her, they told her about it. But they kept it because they wanted to give it to him themselves. Go where you will through every land that plays cricket, and you will find this love for our friend, love for this man out of whose inmost being there flowed in quiet abundance the healing, refreshing power of goodness. You who worked with him, you who played with him, will remember also in him a tranquility not often found in a man so young. His boyhood friends told me that there was something of this quality in him even while he was a boy growing up in Barbados. But tranquility of spirit cannot exist where feeling is absent. Tranquility exists only in those who have gained an inner strength, those who have felt the wind and storm, those who have endured testing, those who have been through conflict, those who have found assurance in the end. I think it was of this that Wordsworth wrote when he said that he learned to look on nature not as in the hour of thoughtless youth, but hearing oftentimes the still, sad music of humanity, nor harsh, nor grating, though of ample power to chasten and subdue. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air and the blue sky and in the mind of man. And it is this capacity for feeling and for gaining tranquility, this capacity for insight, that led William Faulkner in one of the most notable and solemn utterances of our time to challenge the artist of his generation to leave no room in his workshop for anything but the old verities and truths of the heart, the old universal truths, lacking which any story is ephemeral and doomed. Love and honor and pity and pride and compassion and sacrifice, which led him to declare that man will not merely endure, but will prevail, because he has a soul, a spirit, capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance. Frank died at the early age of 42. He must have known, as a man, moments of great doubt and conflict. For already, while still young, you knew that there was within him an inner strength, hard as steel, gentle as love, trusting as a child's smile. It was a comfort to his widow to speak of his love for this university and above all for its students. He had offers of other jobs, more highly paid. She told me how on one occasion When a generous offer had been made to him, he discussed it with her, and then he said, "Valdo, I can't take it. This is our university. We must work for it. We must be proud of it. We must give it everything we have." This was the spirit that moved him to cable to my friend Dudley Huggins, when the Frank Worrell cricket fields were being opened at St. Augustine a week or so before his death. With the help of friends and benefactors, he had converted 17 and a half acres of rough land into an excellent ground for games and athletics. And he cabled best wishes to all, and then he went on to say, "I wish I were with you. Thanks to Gary and to the team. Special thanks to all. Thanks to my many contributors of labor, capital, machinery, material, advice. Good luck to all." A few days later, he died. I saw him on the Saturday morning briefly. None of us there thought that the end was so near. I think for the first time in his illness, he was in pain. It is always hard to watch illness. It is hard even when there is good hope of recovery. It is heartbreaking when there is no hope within earthly reach. So hard to watch enfeebled that body that moved with such elegant strength, with such gracious ease. He died next morning. He suddenly sat up in bed and then fell back. And there was, said his widow, a smile on his face. She was telling me this in the aeroplane, and as she spoke to me, there came into my mind the memory of Mr. Valiant for Truth, of how he was taken with a summons, of how he went down to the riverside. And as he went down deeper, he said, "Grave, where is thy victory?" So he passed over, and the trumpet sounded for him on the other side. At this time, while we meet here, the body of Sir Frank Worrell is being laid to rest in a corner of our university campus at Cave Hill in Barbados, near the playing fields. In a place of great beauty, almost within sound of the sea, looking across to Bridgetown and to the fields where Frank Worrell first won recognition as a cricketer. Brave spirit, what would you have us, your friends who mourn for you, what would you have us remember? What words of comfort would you have us carry in our hearts from this place? The doctors and nurses who wept when you died, those who played and worked with you, those in many lands who admired and loved you. Would you not bid us to find courage and comfort and perhaps even happiness in him whom you trusted, in him whom you believed? Would you not have us turn to him also, a man with his youth upon him, a man who promised life though he was about to die, a man who faced hostility and death and with assurance cried, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come unto me. Whosoever believeth in me, let him drink. As scripture says, streams of living water shall flow out from within him."